Talk given Sunday, January 2nd, 1972. Why is it that one is moved to tears when one hears wonderful music or listens to words which go deep into our hearts? Or reads something which elevates the mind, or one experiences the beauty of nature, or sometimes a simple thing like the smile of a baby. Why is one moved to tears? Is it impossible for a human being to bear happiness? What lies in the deeps of the psyche, which reacts in terms of tears? Is not memory one of the powerful influences which brings about that curious reaction? The memory of the past, locked away, hidden, secret. The memory of what we have failed to achieve in life. The memory of frustrations, of unsatisfied longings, of actual misery and pain inflicted on us from outside. And that memory gives rise to that pain in the immediate present, which wells out in tears, because when the event occurred in the past, when we went through the frustration or sorrow, or if you like, the excess of pleasure, satisfaction of desire, and all the rest of it, when we went through that, we had not completely understood the living experience in the now and worked it out totally. Because we do not attend perfectly to the now, all the impressions which come to us through our senses, all our senses, and all that arises from within our own psyche because of memory, because of anticipation, desire, planning, and all the rest of it, all that is not fully worked out. Therefore, those forces, and all sense impressions and so on are forces, they sink into the psyche unworked, unworked out. This is the meaning of what in Hindu Buddhist teaching has been called a substrate for rebirth. And remember that the word used actually is jati. whose essential meaning and practical meaning is the conditioned state, or for the re-arising of a conditioned state. Our English word rebirth or reincarnation or any similar word is an unfortunate word to use in this context. All this happens now whilst we are living, between the birth of this very body and up to the death of this very body. So these impressions sink, to use a modern psychological term, sink into our personal unconscious, waiting to be worked out. Because there's nothing in the psyche which is dead. Our memories are memories of the dead past. The dead past, in the sense that it has sunk into the limbo of time which has gone by. But these memories, these mental impressions, the Sanskrit term is vasanas, they are living ghosts which we carry about in our own psyche. They are corpses which can be reanimated at any moment, reanimated by any sense impression or any event which by association recalls that dead past. So these vasanas, these mental impressions which have sunk into the psyche, into the depths of the psyche, mummified things as they are reanimated and they come back and hurt again, or cause remorse again for any wrongs we have done, or vain regrets, if only I had had the sense to do this or act thus or behave thus, all this wouldn't have come about. If only I had done my duty by my parents and by the country or whatever it is, all those vain regrets wouldn't come up if we had completely worked it out then and there. But we don't work it out like that. So you see, that is on the side of the unpleasant. There is the side of the pleasant, if you like, in terms of fantasy, of longing. Right from childhood onwards, we go through fantasies. We talk about the child's imagination and what a rich imagination it is. The imagination is an image-making faculty. There is in every one of us, from birth onwards, an extraordinary natural power of aspiration. A power which wants us to move towards something transcendent, something absolutely wonderful, and we talk of it in childish language as forever and ever. But it is a shadow of the awareness, the unconscious awareness that there is the eternal, the immortal. Now all these aspirations which we have in childhood, which take shapes in the imagination of the child, are conditioned by the sense impressions that we present to the child. Largely we present them, those around, because the parents and those who are immediately associated with the infant are the most powerful sources for conditioning the child mind. And of course, when the child grows up and discovers that this is not real, this is all pretending, there is pain in the psyche, there is pain in the soul. This wonderful heaven that one dreams of, the wings of gold and light with which we are going to fly through the aerial spaces and all the rest of it, the passionate clinging to life so that forever and ever we shall live and never know sorrow and die, all those are found to be pretense and not real. And therefore there is pain in the psyche. There is pain in the psyche. And when we have any sort of experiences, such as wonderful music, or the beauty of flowers, or the singing of birds, which are a reflection of that which in our childhood meant supreme happiness and fulfillment. Because all that is unfulfilled, it is recalled by the exquisiteness, the perfection of art, nature, and so forth. So we are moved to tears. We are moved to tears also when we get flashes of inspiration. When deep inspiration comes, when there is a sudden vision within oneself of the reality of transcendence, the sense of conviction that there is only life eternal. When we are moved to tears by that sort of inspiration, that sort of elevated state, a lightened up state of mind, it is because we also unconsciously are aware of all that lies in us which obstructs this transcendence from being with us, in us, and functioning perpetually through us from this very moment onwards. Something in us knows, the flash has come and it is gone. The light of the sun is dimmed, sometimes eclipsed. So you see the importance of attentiveness, the significance of attentiveness. If there is complete attentiveness, true attention, then the whole of the dualistic becoming process, the pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow process and experiencing, would be taken by us in a state of perfect poise and balance and inward harmony in our stride. There would be neither loud laughter or cheering, nor would there be gloom and tears and depression. There would be true happiness, true peace, true well-being. This state of well-being, our true welfare, is something of which we know nothing. And it all hinges round this extraordinary instrument of salvation that is us, that is ours, this power of attentiveness. Buddhism calls it mindfulness. Krishnamurti always uses the word attention, awareness. Jesus said, watch and pray. Zarathustra taught that it is the duty of every man to be filled with the good mind, as he called it. This pure mind, mind only, the transcendent mind, which is the creative power perpetually in action. This power of attention. But it must be pure attention, pure mindfulness. Because if it is not pure mindfulness, we will move from one jati, conditioned state, into another jati. If our mindfulness and attentiveness is desire-driven, if it has ulterior motives involved in it, if it is exercised with an objective in view, something to gain or to achieve, then that mindfulness is impure mindfulness. There is no substantial reality to the self which is riddled with selfness. And selfness simply means that one is conscious in the world, one is attentive in the world, in a self-oriented manner, in a manner which isolates one from the totality, in a manner which is concerned, therefore, with the fulfillment of one's own desire and will, and is unwilling, and more often than not actually opposes that transcendent energy, that transcendent power which is working through everything in the universe, including ourselves, in order to bring to fruition every manifestation of itself in the cosmos. And we human beings on this planet are perhaps hitherto, so far, the supreme manifestation of this creative activity of transcendence. And as we all know, we have the power of looking within ourselves, becoming self-conscious, as no other can become self-conscious. And because we are unenlightened, because we are unawakened, because we do not really care or really love, we are self-conscious in an isolative manner, cutting us off from the totality. Self-centered. When that is the case, the truth and the reality of the self is completely hidden from us. When we really awaken to this, fat, then our conditioned state, the imprisoned state of the psyche, begins to change. Freedom emerges. It is not that we have to seek freedom. It is not that we have to break our chains and cast them aside by will, by force, by violent activity. Because remember that all that we call the qualities of the mind or the psyche or our own character, they themselves are our psyche. My chains are my psyche. If I break my chains, it is tantamount to saying, I break my psyche. The psychotic, the lunatic, the mindless one, the devilish one, these are the consequences. So that is not the way. It's not a case of driving out the evil, of overcoming the evil by conquest. It is not even a case of intellectually differentiating the evil from the good, and then saying, I will abide by the good and remove the evil. We only perpetuate the conflict that way. It is not a case of that, but it is a case of being attentive so completely that every self-isolative element in that attention is out. Then the psyche no longer grasps. Again, remember the Buddha's words, Ananda, the freedom of attention, of attentiveness, of mindfulness from all grasping is indeed nirvana. Now, he couldn't have said anything more unequivocally than that. The freedom of the mind, of the psyche, if you like, citta. Citta is the word that is actually used in the original Pali. The freedom of the mind from all grasping is indeed nirvana. Now, when we see that and we attend to that way, we are attending with a pure attention. It is a state of pure mindfulness. And that means that the conditioned state is no longer there. This psychophysical being, oneself, is now empty in mind. All the collected heap, the burden of the past, of memories, of ills, of pleasures, and all the rest of it is out. And when that is the case, the psyche is pure light, transparent. You see why angels or the souls of the saints are painted as full of light. They are always presented as made of light. Think of it. It's an extraordinary thing. consider a very interesting little association with that. Modern science says that if an object were to move faster and faster and faster, time would become less and less and less for it, until when the speed of light is attained, time stands still. There is no time. If you move with the speed of light, there is no time. If you could physically move with the speed of light, you will never grow a second older. If time stands still, what is there? The timeless, is it not? And is not being in the timeless, is not awareness which is timeless, immortality? Now do not think, therefore, by analogy, this is where the analogy fails, this is in physical terms, that is to say, in terms of measurable energy. But in terms of transcendent energy, which is immeasurable, spaceless and timeless, the depths of eternity are absolutely silent and unmoving. You see, in terms of that energy, the psyche, the mind, thought, does not have to move. There is no speed involved in it. It is utterly free of the dimensions of space and time. It is utterly free of that. It is awareness which is eternally here now. If we use physical analogy, remember there are two infinities. There is the infinity which is our common feeling with regard to infinity, the boundless, bigger and bigger and bigger forever and ever, no end to it. But very few of us are at all properly aware of the other infinity, get smaller and smaller and smaller and become the point. The geometrical point has neither length, nor breadth, nor depth. It is non-finite. The finite is measurable, but the point is immeasurable. Now the mind, if you still want to use physical analogies to help, is perhaps more nearly related to the point than to the boundless, to the boundlessness of space. But if it is the point, it has no need to move. It is infinite. It is absolute. You see? Now, relate to this what you read in the Upanishads, for instance, about Brahman, Atma, about the eternal, about the absolute. standing still, it overtakes everybody or everything that is moving and running. Unmoving, it is everywhere. You see? This is the nature of transcendent awareness. Have you ever experienced anything like that? Have you ever known what it is like to touch that infinity, that absoluteness? When the mind is utterly empty, it is completely free of all desire. It is completely free of all calculation, of all planning, of all describing. When it is completely free of all these things, every one of which is limited, particular, is born, proceeds, and dies. When the mind is free in that way, through the power of pure attentiveness, then you will experience that infinity. And if you happen to be one who has who is blessed with the power of speech, the power of prophetic speech, what words you use when you speak of such things will be words which bear some close relationship to the unspeakable reality. Now, if a person, because he has a brilliant intellect, has the power to penetrate into these things and rear up a logical structure, were to write about it, speak about it, he can speak very eloquently indeed, but he himself, not having realized that truth, will be unable to exercise this subtle, mysterious, unknown power which transforms his environment, the world he lives in, which has the power to change a human being. He may inspire him, he may send him away with a feeling, oh, what a genius that man is. He really told me the most marvelous things. And after a while, all the effects are worn off. It is as if he has presented you with a saucer of alcohol and you say, oh, how marvelous this thing is, and you want to possess it and keep it, and you know it evaporates away, and 3 days later you come and look at an empty saucer. That is all it is. Heady stuff. But if the Holy One were to communicate this to us, then we are changed forever. We need not know, we need not perceive the forms of that change at all. It's not necessary. We have benefited. We have grown in the true sense. Supposing you go for a holiday to a quiet place, a really beautiful place, and you are in tune with all the forces of life. Something happens in your soul. There is creative renewal which has taken place. And you come back, and you know you are different. And if you are wise, you will know that you are different inwardly. The outer effects, in terms of good health and rosy cheeks and all the rest of it, all that will vanish away with the turmoil of everyday life. But this inward change will live in you. You are a fitter vehicle of transcendence. So too, when one experiences holiness through pure attentiveness, but remember the nature of that purity. It has to be totally free of all desire, of all grasping. The desire for God, for perfection, is just as binding as the desire for wine, women, song, and so forth. Why? If I desire God, I invariably picture God. What is my picture of the infinite, of the transcendent? It is a picture which betrays my ignorance, my foolishness, my incapacity. That is what it shows. The natural aspiration, the pure aspiration, which is an outwelling light to the transcendent, is a power of life from within oneself which goes out to transcendence without restriction, without any picturing, which is as infinite and omnipotent as transcendence itself. That aspiration is untainted by desire. That is pure aspiration, because it is aspiration not concerned with obtaining the transcendent. That is why there is no selfness in it. That is a case where transcendence is awakening to transcendence. You know, when the mind is still and pure, and it clicks into tune, gets on the right wavelength with this transcendent vibration, then there is an extraordinary happiness, an extraordinary freedom from the state of conflict, from confusion, from darkness, from misery. A freedom by virtue of which one moves in the ordinary everyday world through the conditions of misery and pain and difficulty and perplexity and so forth, experiencing, as far as the sense apparatus of the body will record it, the pleasure pain feelings, the joy sorrow feelings, but unmoved by it. This is the important thing. This is the peace that we can realize in our ordinary everyday life. This is the inward security that can be there. A security which is transcendent, undefiled by our childish, absurd definitions and conceptions of security. And therefore a security which will enable us to move through all the stress, the turmoil, the fearful things, the insecurity of the becoming process. Never will you find security anywhere in the universe. There is none. You may cry for the moon, and nowadays you can get there. But if you cry for the moon as a piece of green cheese, that you will never get. Because the moon as a piece of green cheese is the denial of fact. You see? That is what we do. So now look. Look deep into the heart, into the mind. Be watchful. Be watchful. But in this watchfulness, be quite free of the attitude of being on guard. We associate the watchman with the feeling of being on guard against this, that, or the other. You are watchful, you are mindful without being on guard. Therefore, everything is absorbed by you with complete attention. Nothing is refused. Nothing is accepted with pleasure in the sense of grasping. You neither grasp at anything nor do you cast aside anything. If the mind is like that, are there any others for you? Is there anything which is an outside object? Something desirable to possess or any such foolish thing? Not at all. In your awareness, you are awake to the one total reality. That is the way God is. The ever wakeful one, the unsleeping immortal eyes that never close, that everlastingly see and know everything. Practice this. But approach the practice of it without the feeling of a set task. It is because so many hundreds, thousands in this country alone, earnest, sincere people, approach religion and transcendence as a set task, which means something to achieve, to gain, and all the rest of it, you see, that they fail all along the line. They think they are progressing, they are getting on. Of course, they may learn wonderful things with the mind, with the intellect. They may develop powers of concentration, as the world calls it. They may achieve this, that, and the other. But the whole lot of it goes into the grave. That awakened awareness, which ultimately is one with transcendence itself, is the thing that is not there. Now remember, in our ordinary everyday life, at least whilst we are awake, we do pay attention. We have to pay attention, isn't it? But we pay attention to everything in not the religious way. We pay attention to it with our awareness confined to the worldly manifestation of it. Do try this out carefully. When you're cooking a meal, when you're doing your professional work, when you're carrying out, experiencing something which you have decided to experience, go to a concert or a theater, or go and meet somebody, or go to a meeting or something. See? Now, in all those instances, the attention given is given in the worldly manner. Be intensely observant here. If you give your attention in the truly religious manner, you'll be quite unself-conscious. Not unconscious. You'll be quite unself-conscious. You'll never be aware of yourself as something separate from the total environment, which includes all objects and people and whatever that is. You see? If you do realize this state, that is to say, if this transcendent state gets realized through you, you will never know it during the experiencing. Afterwards, when you once more fall into matter, into the limited state, the sinful state, the separated state, you will, as in common language, wake up with a start and say, oh, so that must have been a case of the realization of transcendence. Then beware of the devil. Ah, I had an experience of transcendence. And be very, very careful of that bloated I, of that miserable separate self, become a thousandfold more miserable and evil super self. The little signs of the self become super self. One goes and starts off a movement willfully. Now, I've got a call from God, and I become the militant instrument for dragging everybody into my net in actuality, deluding myself and, worst of all the others, that they are being taken to God, to liberation, to transcendence, to eternal fulfillment. Beware of all this. The ways of the self, the separatist self, are so subtle, so clever. We are always caught. We are born with a handicap. Our eyes are placed like this, and we see only a little bit, and we don't see the rest, especially that which is behind us. And the devil claims the place of honor by sitting on his throne at the back of our heads. So you see, he always gets us. But when you become mindful in purity, then the devil's throne vanishes. And he himself becomes utterly transformed into God, the eternal good. Because the devil is the technical ability of God. The devil is the technique, the expresser, the one who brings into manifestation. And that means to bring into limitation, to finitude, introduce ambivalence, conflict, mortality. But this is all part of the process of manifestation. And it is all embodied, and it all takes place through our own psychophysical organism. And above all, do remember that the purity of mindfulness means that we are constantly awake, constantly watching the actual condition state, the actual confusion, the actual lust, greed, delusion, pleasure, the sense of the elation, the feeling of sublimity, and all the rest of it which is going through us. It is all that we can observe. And when we can really observe that, all that, without any grasping, then all devilishness is out. All devilishness, all limitation, conflict, and so on, is something which lies in the context which can be recognized, recognized by our discriminative consciousness. Transcendence can never be recognized, can never even be cognized for the first time by discriminative consciousness. When discriminative consciousness is utterly free of all its taints, then this pure awareness is your actual being. Those of you who have studied these things, you all know the words. Brahman is described as Sat Chit Ananda. And we all say dutifully, being consciousness bliss. And we think, yes, we know all about Brahman now. You know, a parrot can say those words. You've only got to say them pretty poorly. Brahman is Sat Chit Ananda. And that parrot will repeat it like the wisest of us. Maybe the parrot is even wiser than us in actuality. That he says the word of God without his little mind besmirching the word of God as ours does with our greed and our possessiveness and our desire. So you see, this state of purity means being fully aware of the actual presence of the impurity. And when that awareness, when that attentiveness reaches a white heat, this is the real meaning of the god Agni in the Rig Veda, the god of fire. And in all the mythologies of the world, the god of fire, all the symbolisms represent this white heat. When that is right there all the time, you're always in that state of white heat, all impurity is burnt up, not destroyed. This burning is a transforming. It's a transforming with an interesting difference from the usual thing that is said about it, that all the dross is burnt away and the pure gold comes out. Here, the dross also is transformed into pure gold. You see, I have sometimes said, in fact I have often said during the years at these meetings, that I care for your happiness, for your well-being. I say that on the one hand, and on the other hand, it looks as if I try to cut everything from underneath your feet. It is because I care that I try to do so. It is because I care that I say, keep away from religion unless you mean business. And if you mean business, you will plunge into death which is transmutation, which will transfigure your whole being. And lift you to your true status. As the Pythagorean teachings put it, and when you reach that pure ether, you will be immortal God. And what is the reaching that pure ether? It is this state of pure attention which has freed us completely from the shackles of isolation and separativeness. And therefore there is purity, peace, wisdom, love, and beauty.